From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
Overwhelming American military power, air, land, and sea, was used to launch a spectacular assault. And it was an assault like people have not seen since World War II. It was a force against a heavily fortified military fortress in the heart of Caracas to bring outlaw dictator Nicolas Maduro to justice. This was one of the most stunning, effective, and powerful displays of American military might and competence in American history.
That was President Donald Trump highlighting the successful U.S. military operation that captured Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. Happy New Year, and welcome to this January 5th edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, coming up, Venezuela's deposed leader Nicolas Maduro made his first court appearance in New York, pleading not guilty to narco-terrorism and other charges. Now, United Nations officials, including UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, warned the U.S. operation may have been illegal. We'll speak with former DOJ Prosecutor Richard Gregory to break it all down. Plus, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz drops his reelection bid amid a $9 billion welfare fraud scandal. Federal funding has been frozen, and hearings are now underway. Is this yet another example of government largesse fueling corruption? Assistant Secretary for Family Support at the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Alex Adams, will join us later. Well, as I mentioned, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty in a New York federal court today to U.S. narcotics and weapons charges following his capture by American special forces in the capital of the South American country. Prosecutors accused Maduro of leading a long-running cocaine trafficking operation linked to violent criminal groups. Maduro denies the allegations. Now, the arrest has drawn international condemnation and raised legal questions over the U.S. operation. Joining me now is Washington Stand reporter Sarah Holliday, who has been following today's main stories. Sarah, Maduro and his wife both appeared briefly in court as Venezuela's government remains in place. What did we learn from today's hearing?
Thank you, Tony. Maduro pleaded not guilty to four charges, including narco-terrorism and cocaine importation conspiracy. And he said through an interpreter that he is innocent. His wife, Celia Flores, also entered a not guilty plea. Prosecutors say Maduro oversaw drug trafficking for years, working with Mexican cartels and Colombian guerrillas. Defense lawyers said they expect a legal fight over what they called a military abduction. Meanwhile, the United States defended the operation at an emergency UN Security Council meeting. Here is what the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Mike Walz, said at the meeting.
There is no war against Venezuela or its people. We are not occupying a country. This was a law enforcement operation in furtherance of lawful indictments that have existed for decades. The United States arrested a narco trafficker who is now going to stand trial in the United States in accordance with the rule of law for the crimes he's committed against our people for 15 years.
Tony, Russia, China, and Colombia condemned the move, warning it violates international law and risks destabilizing the region. Tony.
Well, thank you, Sarah. We're going to talk more about Venezuela a little bit later and drill down on some of those arguments. Now, Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who was Kamala Harris's running mate in 2024, will not seek a third term. Now, he steps aside as federal investigators expose fraud in the state's welfare program. Sarah, other than a potentially $9 billion fraud investigation, why is Walz leaving the race now?
That's right, Tony. Tim Walz announced earlier today that he will not run for re-election to focus on welfare fraud allegations that have shaken his administration. Here's what he had to say at a press conference.
Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who want to prey on our differences. So I've decided to step out of this race, and I'll let others worry about the election while I focus on the work that's in front of me for the next year.
Federal authorities say the scandal involves up to $9 billion in misused taxpayer funds, with at least 56 people pleading guilty. Critics say the crisis highlights mismanagement under Walz, while Republicans see an opening to reclaim the governor's office. Potential candidates, including Senator Amy Klobuchar, are now weighing a run in November. Tony.
All right, Sarah. Interesting. We'll be watching that one over the next several months. So New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani, the first Muslim and self-described Democratic socialist to hold the office of mayor of New York City, has revoked several executive orders that were put in place by former Mayor Eric Adams, including protections for Jewish New Yorkers and restrictions on boycotts of Israel. Sarah, how has the Jewish community there responded?
The Jewish community is concerned, Tony. Mamdani, as you mentioned, a socialist Democrat, overturned Adams' orders that safeguarded Jewish New Yorkers and limited city support for boycotts of Israel. He also scrapped the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which critics say weakens protections against hate. Israel's foreign ministry condemned the move, saying Mamdani shows his true face by lifting restrictions on boycotts and discarding internationally recognized anti-Semitism standards. They called it, quote, anti-Semitic gasoline on an open fire. While Mamdani frames the changes as promoting civil rights, opponents warn they put New York's Jewish community at risk and send a troubling message globally.
Well, I think it certainly does. Thanks so much, Sarah, for bringing us up to date on the headlines for today. These are all stories that we'll be continuing to watch. All right, I want to go back to the U.S. operation in Venezuela and get the perspective of a member of Congress who's actually dealt with foreign drug cartels. Joining me now is Congressman John McGuire, a member of the House Armed Services Committee and the Oversight and Government Reform Committees. He is also a Navy SEAL veteran who has deployed on missions against cartels across South and Central America. He represents the 5th Congressional District of Virginia. Congressman McGuire, welcome back to Washington Watch. Happy New Year. Great to see you.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Tony. Great to see you. Really appreciate what you do. Yeah, you know, back in the 90s, my SEAL team and I, we did counter-drug missions in just about every country, South Central America. But one country that stood out was Venezuela. It was clean, it was safe, and it was prosperous. You'd go to a restaurant in the city of Caracas and you would see Porsches and Ferraris. And then Chavez brought in socialism, Maduro. And what socialism does is it puts the boot on people's neck. It creates tyranny and it makes everyone poor. And the country is unrecognizable. And I wouldn't even, it's almost like not even a country now. It's more of a proxy for Iran, Russia, and China. But by the grace of God, our incredible military, President Trump's leadership, Pete Hegseth, the entire military got in, got out, didn't lose one person, didn't lose any equipment. Rubio, General Raising Cane, our law enforcement, just by the grace of God, they got that done. And I'm so glad that we got them in and out. No one got killed.
So Congressman, let's, in fact, in just a little bit, the president and his team will be briefing some of the members of Congress on this, but let's talk a little bit about the rationale here, the impact upon the United States. Why was this an issue for the United States?
Well, you know, I actually joined SEAL Team 4 after SEAL training. I replaced a guy. We lost four guys in Bravo Platoon, SEAL Team 4, back after, during the invasion of Panama with Noriega. And think about how much money we spent, how much time it took to get Noriega. And these guys went in and got out so easy. It just shows you how far we've come. But if you remember, under the Biden DOJ, they indicted Maduro for this drug trafficking and human trafficking and all the problems that he's caused in our country. You may remember there's a $25 million price on his head. It went up to $50 million. And in Colorado, these Venezuelan gang members took over an apartment complex at gunpoint and cut the fingers off of people that would speak up on it. And so they brought unspeakable evil into our country. And President Trump sent a loud message across the world that we're going to defend the American people at home and abroad, and our hemisphere and our country are now safer. So it's it was an arrest. It was a law enforcement military operation. He is now on U.S. soil. And of course, he was brought before the judge today.
So he was basically, I mean, there's questions about the legitimacy of his election as president. That's been questioned not just by the United States, but a multitude of nations. But he's basically running a criminal conspiracy there with drug lords and others as a part of running these drugs into the United States. So there clearly was a concern on behalf of the United States and the impact it was having here on our country.
Oh, big time. In fact, he caused a lot of disruption in the region and our country. And, you know, I think you remember Lake and Riley was killed by a Venezuelan. And there's so many deaths like hers around this country that could have been prevented. And I've knocked on six doors in my district where a mother or a father prayed with me and cried with me because their 18, 19, 20-year-old son or daughter is dead. Now, we've lost more people from overdose since 2020 than died in World War II. And if that's not a war, I don't know what war is. So we have got to stop that. And President Trump and his administration are saying no more. We're going for American exceptionalism, and we're going to keep American people safe.
Well, Congressman, I would agree with that. And I do think we have to address the supply side of drugs. And that's long been a focus of American foreign policy. But I would also say that this administration, and I've repeatedly said this, needs to focus on the demand side. And we have to be asking the questions, why do we have more people using drugs, illegal drugs, in this country that's fueling those deaths that you made reference to?
Well, it's interesting you say that. Well, first of all, you think about this. Drug trafficking across the world's ocean has dropped 97% in the last month or so for some reason. But when I knocked on these doors where these parents prayed with me, they would say something to the effect, and I'm talking big mansions all the way down to people that live in mobile home, you know, trailer courts. It doesn't matter what your race, religion, creed, or money situation is. People are dying and being poisoned. I had one parent say that my child was a 4.5 GPA student, never smoked cigarettes or anything, just went to a party and tried something, and it was laced with fentanyl or something in the cocaine or marijuana, and it killed their kid. So you're right. If we could figure that answer out, we could solve a lot of problems. Why is there a demand? Because if we don't get rid of the demand, these cartels and these drug dealers are going to figure out a way to get their drugs here.
You're right. And I think that's a community focus. It's not just the government. I mean, I think it speaks to an underlying both spiritual and moral issue that we have to address that the government can't. I just think that we need to put more of an emphasis on, you know, the supply as well as the demand as well as the supply. Congressman McGuire, always great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks again for your service to our country.
Hey, God bless you. Thank you.
I do think, you know, we're going to look at this more throughout the rest of this program. I think there is justification what the Trump administration did and how they went about it. There's precedent there. Again, I think we need to look at this problem that our nation is facing holistically. There's some personal responsibility here as well. All right, we're going to be looking at the scandal in Minnesota. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews says that the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and of spirit, of joints and of marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. Stand on the Word is Family Research Council's journey through the living and active Word of God. Follow the plan with us. Spend 10 to 15 minutes a day reading God's Word, and over the course of 2 years, discover that the Bible is one big story, a story of many words, pointing to the Word, the one who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Because the Word is alive, and His name is Jesus. Find our Bible reading plan and daily devotionals from Tony Perkins at frc.org/Bible. Join us as we stand on the Word.
At Family Research Council, we believe religious freedom is a fundamental human right that all governments must protect. For years, Islamist militants in Nigeria have targeted Christians and other religious minority groups with brutal violence. Since 2009, 52,000 Christians have been slaughtered. A staggering 89% of Christian martyrs in the world today are from Nigeria. The first Trump administration declared Nigeria a country of particular concern, a designation reserved for countries whose governments engage in or tolerate religious freedom violations. However, this designation of Nigeria was quickly reversed by the Biden administration. Following consistent calls from FRC President Tony Perkins and other religious leaders across the U.S., President Donald Trump has responded.
Christianity is facing an existential threat in Nigeria. Thousands and thousands of Christians are being killed. I am hereby making Nigeria a country of particular concern.
This is a huge step forward for the protection of Christians in Nigeria, as well as religious freedom across the world. While this opens the door for the U.S. government to pressure Nigerian leaders to protect vulnerable Christians, it is only the beginning. We must continue to pray diligently, work strategically, and stand firm for the protection of religious liberty across the globe.
Looking for a trusted source of news that shares your Christian values? Turn to The Washington Stand, your ultimate destination for informed, faith-centered reporting. Our dedicated team goes beyond the headlines, delivering stories that matter most to believers. From breaking events to cultural insights, we provide clear, compassionate coverage through a biblical lens. Discover news you can trust at The Washington Stand, where faith and facts meet every day.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us. The website, frc.org, or you can go to tonyperkins.com. Earlier today, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz announced that he will abandon his bid for re-election amid the widening welfare fraud scandal in his state, the state of Minnesota, that has drawn national attention. Now, later this week, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee will hold the first of two hearings on the scandal. Now, federal prosecutors estimate the fraud could top $9 billion in taxpayer money. Now, in the meantime, the Department of Health and Human Services has also taken action, freezing all federal funding to the state's child care providers. Join me now to discuss this, Assistant Secretary for Family Support, Dr. Alex Adams, who leads the Administration for Children and Families at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Assistant Secretary Adams, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate you being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're coming back from the holidays. Some in our audience may not have been following closely the news during the holiday period or may just heard bits and pieces. So give us kind of the overview. Start and share with us what we know so far about this scandal that seems to be very widespread.
Yeah, well, as you said, fraud is rampant in Minnesota. A prosecutor has estimated that the total fraud across multiple different programs is $9 billion. One of the programs implicated is the Child Care Development Fund, which my agency, the Administration for Children and Families, oversees. Around the holidays, a video was posted on social media going to different daycare facilities, finding that there were very few, if any, children there, alleging some to be false storefronts. Unfortunately, those allegations align well with past reports. Just this past May, HHS's Inspector General had issued a report questioning the attendance records practices in Minnesota, suggesting that it was leading to overpayment. So the scale of the fraud is eye-popping, and unfortunately, it does not just impact those in Minnesota. It impacts all American taxpayers because these are federal dollars that are given to the state, a portion of which are then stolen by fraudsters.
You know, Assistant Secretary, when I look at this, there's a couple of questions come to mind. Number one, it's so widespread, it can't be isolated. It has to be coordinated. It's almost as someone has to be driving this. It doesn't just happen.
Well, either through negligence or malice, you know, Governor Walz has overseen one of the largest welfare fraud scandals in American history. And I think it's appropriate that he's stepping away. That doesn't mean that we will let up on the gas. It doesn't mean we will stop our efforts to uncover the scope and size and magnitude of this fraud. But I think it's a good first step. A couple things that we did to nip this in the bud. We took three quick actions last week. First, we put up on our website, childcare.gov, a tip line for anyone with allegations of fraud, waste, or abuse to report to us directly. To date, we've received about 280 tips nationwide and from multiple different states. I mean, it does appear that this exists outside of that state as well. We did ask for an audit, too, of Minnesota and some of the daycare facilities specifically named. Yeah, the third thing is we set up a defend the spend system where states, prior to drawing down funds for child care, have to substantiate their drawdown with evidence of legitimacy.
Now, I want to go back to something you said a moment ago, that the Inspector General report that there had, or an audit, there had been an audit that had raised these questions regarding attendance records and the billing. Did state officials take any action on that whatsoever?
I'm not aware of any actions they've taken, because certainly some of the social media reports are subsequent to the release of that. The other thing to know is this had been on the Trump administration radar for a while. Earlier in December, well in advance of those social media videos, we had sent letters to Governor Walz and his administration asking for more information on the child care program, some of their cash assistance programs, some of their block grants. And we had asked for very specific information from them by December 26. Unfortunately, they did not provide a substantive response. They asked for a delay into this month. So they've got about a week to provide answers to us. But we're hoping to get to the bottom of that soon.
Now, you mentioned, Secretary Adams, that this is going to affect, I mean, this affects not just the families and people in Minnesota, but this affects all Americans, all taxpayers.
Yeah, just as one example, in this child care program, American taxpayers send $185 million out each year to the state of Minnesota, and Minnesota is supposed to administer that with fidelity, and they're supposed to, in the child care program, get it to families in need, families who are working, who would not be able to join the workforce but for having child care support. And every dollar stolen by one of these fraudsters is taken from the pocket of children and families. Certainly one of the things we've said is fraud does not occur in a vacuum. The policies from Washington can either enable it or impede it. And unfortunately, what we saw during the Biden-Harris administration is a lot of the policies that were adopted in Washington made fraud easier. In the child care program, for example, the Biden administration had adopted regulations that would have required states to pay child care providers in advance based on enrollment rather than after the fact based on attendance records that are verifiable. That would have turbocharged fraud. So in addition to those actions that we took last week, the Trump administration today published a proposed rule to eliminate those Biden-era provisions, and we're trying to get these programs back on the right path, which is to help the children and families for whom Congress intended.
We just have about a minute and a half left, but when you look back during COVID, where there was just this infusion of cash into the states, and now, of course, part of the fraud in being uncovered here is connected to the COVID-era funding. But is it not also an issue of scale when the government is sending so much money, creating so many social programs, that it's just hard to keep track of it?
Yeah, well, Tony, I think the best way I've heard it described is the Biden administration with ARPA and some of their pandemic-era funds essentially sent the Briggs truck full of cash out to the states and sent the security home. So, you know, I think, you know, as the president has said, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg so far. But Americans can have confidence that we're going to uncover the size and magnitude of this, and we're going to do everything we can to return those dollars back to hardworking Americans.
Well, we appreciate what the Trump administration is doing and appreciate you joining us today to give us the latest on what's happening as it pertains to families and children in Minnesota and elsewhere. Assistant Secretary Adams, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think it's a part of it is just the government has gotten so big providing so many programs, it just can't keep track of it. And of course, you get liberal governments like we see in Minnesota, and it's just ripe for fraud. We're going to be watching this closely over the next several weeks to see what's uncovered. All right, don't go away. More straight ahead. For over 4,000 years, the Jewish people have had legal, historical, and biblical ties to the land of Israel, especially the heartland of Israel, Judea and Samaria, which much of the world still calls the West Bank. To Israelis, Judea and Samaria is far more than a name. It's the center of their ancestral homeland, where nearly 80% of the Bible's events took place. Abraham purchased property in Hebron, Jacob in Shechem. Joshua made an altar on Mount Ebal and led the Israelites into a covenant before God. On Mount Gerizim, overlooking Shechem, Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman at the well about worshiping neither on Mount Gerizim nor in Jerusalem, but in spirit and in truth. Judea and Samaria is nearly a quarter of Israel's current landmass, not a small strip of land on the Jordan River, but a vital and strategic part of the nation's identity. The October 7th massacre, launched from Gaza, shattered the illusion that giving away territory brings peace. Gaza, which was once seen as the cornerstone of a two-state solution, became a launchpad for terror. Today, only 21% of Israelis support a Palestinian state. Trust in a two-state solution has all but collapsed. The Middle East is changing. Iran's grip is weakening. New alliances are forming. But Western countries and some U.S. officials still chase the mirage of a two-state solution. History speaks clearly. The 2005 Gaza withdrawal, backed by the U.S., led not to peace, but to a terrorist regime. Judea and Samaria are 24 times larger than Gaza, deeply woven into Israel's geographic and spiritual fabric. To surrender them would not bring peace. It would invite conflict and existential danger. Family Research Council stands with Israel's rightful claim to sovereignty. It's time for America to do the same, for history, for justice, and for lasting security in the Middle East. Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you've not yet downloaded the Stand Firm app, I encourage you to go to the App Store, get the Stand Firm app. That way you can watch Washington Watch no matter where you are. All right, earlier today, as we mentioned, Venezuela's deposed leader, Nicolas Maduro, made his first court appearance in New York, where he pleaded not guilty to narco-terrorism conspiracy and three other charges. Since Maduro's capture Saturday, there's been a wide range of reactions. While many are celebrating the dictator's removal, there are some who are questioning the legality of actions taken by the Trump administration. So was the U.S. operation out of step with the rule of law, international law, or our own constitution? Or was it carried out properly? Join me now to discuss this, Dick Gregory, who served at the Department of Justice for 42 years before retiring in 2018. He's best known for his indictments of Panama dictator Manuel Noriega and the Medellin drug cartel. He has also investigated corruption inside the Maduro regime. Dick, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right, let's jump right into this. Many Democrats are decrying the president's actions, arguing that he needed congressional authorization. But it's been very clear, and we heard this today at the UN, at the United Nations, when Ambassador Waltz said that this was not a military action. We're not occupying a country. This was a law enforcement action.
Well, you know, it does appear that there was a warrant outstanding for Mr. Maduro. The question was, is he the head of state? And determining who is a head of state is a diplomatic question, which is handled by the executive branch of government, and not the legislative branch of government. So technically, when our Secretary of State and our president say you are not a head of state, which they have said since this administration started, then Mr. Maduro was not a head of state and not entitled to head of state immunity. Then as far as active state immunity goes, This is a question of whether the actions that Maduro took or what he was doing could not be prosecuted because he was the head of state. Now, if you think about that, if our president goes overseas or if he conducts some action which is totally opposite to what our government is doing, is that prosecutable as a criminal offense in a foreign country? And certainly, if he's not acting as the head of state, he's not performing some a duty that he's required to do as the head of state, is that immune from prosecution? And the answer pretty clearly to that is no. However, the U.S. Constitution, in particular Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, gives Congress the power to enact legislation which is necessary and proper to enforce government actions. So the question is here, it also is constitutionally required that if we go take military action, that should be run by Congress. That is, if we're going to declare war or take some serious military action, Congress should be informed and there should be some congressional action taken. So the issue here is that these acts that we took this past week, did that meet with the Constitution? And that question is going to be raised for some time.
Who will decide that?
Who would decide that? Well, this is a question that will start with the district court in New York and will work its way up, I'm sure, all the way to the Supreme Court.
All right, let's talk about the comparison between Noriega and Maduro. You were there. You were a part of the indictments of Noriega. What are the similarities? What are the differences?
Well, I think that, first of all, the U.S. already had a military in Panama. We were still controlling at the Panama Canal at the time. There was a military presence in Panama, and the U.S. had some good reason for being there that was already set up. Secondly, Noriega was the military head in Panama. He was the head of their intelligence branch. He was a Panamanian military leader. However, he was never made the head of the government. So, and the U.S. did not recognize him as the head of state. And also, his activities with the Medellin cartel, which after the murder of the Minister of Justice in Colombia, the leaders of the Medellin cartel fled to Panama and were put up in Panama, that there was no active state immunity. He wasn't, Noriega wasn't doing something which was asked for by the government or passed by the government, and he wasn't a head of state. So I think there are some questions here. Maduro will claim, I'm sure, that he was the head of state, that he was conducting the government's activities. And I think those arguments will be made in New York. I don't think those arguments are likely to be upheld by the court in New York. I don't think that they will hold water.
But, all right, Dick Gregory, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate the insights. Folks, we're going to continue this conversation with two decorated military veterans involved in this issue next.
Should a Christian support Israel? That question has become one of the most emotionally charged issues of our time, both in the world and within the church. Family Research Council President Tony Perkins offers a clear, biblical, and prophetic answer. In his latest book, he examines Israel's past, present, and future through the lens of Scripture. revealing why support for Israel is not rooted in politics, partisanship, or cultural sentiment, but in the unchanging promises of God. Drawing from Genesis to Revelation, Tony Perkins demonstrates that the ultimate rationale for a Christian support for Israel is spiritual. Should a Christian support Israel invites believers to see beyond headlines and ideologies, returning to the foundation of God's Word to understand His heart for His chosen people and the blessings that flow when we stand with what He has established forever. Text the word Israel to 67742 for more information.
What is God's role in government? What does the separation of church and state really mean? And how does morality shape a nation? President John Adams said our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Join Family Research Council for God and Government, a powerful series that explores the connection between biblical principles and the American government, equipping you with truth to engage in today's most pressing debates. We'll uncover the foundations of our nation's history and why it's relevant for today. Join us to defend God's plan for government, because faith and freedom were never meant to be separate. You can view the course at prayvotestand.org/godandgovernment or on the Stand Firm app.
How should Christians think about the thorny issues shaping our culture? How should Christians address deceitful ideas like transgenderism, critical theory, or assisted suicide? How can Christians navigate raising children in a broken culture, the war on gender roles, or rebuilding our once great nation? Outstanding is a podcast from the Washington Stand dedicated to these critical conversations. Outstanding seeks to tear down what our corrupt culture lifts up, with an aim to take every thought and every idea captive to the obedience of Christ. Whether policies or partisan politics, whether conflict in America or conflict abroad, join us and our guests as we examine the headlines through the lens of Scripture and explore how Christians can faithfully exalt Christ in all of life. Follow Outstanding on your favorite podcast app and look for new episodes each week.
All right, 2026 is now upon us. Wow, I mean, is this, where did 2025 go? Well, I want to encourage you to think about something that could really make a difference this year. All right, we're just in the first full week of the year. I want to invite you to join me on a journey through the Bible to strengthen your biblical worldview in this new year. And you can join me and thousands of other believers for Stand on the Word. It's our two-year chronological journey through the Bible. Reading the Bible for just 15 minutes a day can transform your year. For details, visit frc.org/Bible or text the word Bible to 67742 and join me each day for a journey through the Word of God. And speaking of that, our word for today comes from Genesis chapter 11. Scripture tells us that the whole earth had one language and one speech. As the people journeyed east, they settled in the land of Shinar and began to build. They made bricks, fired them thoroughly, and used asphalt for mortar. Their technological skill was impressive, but their motive revealed the deeper issue. They said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth." Notice their focus. Let us make a name for ourselves. That impulse to secure identity, significance, and security apart from God never ends well. What they feared most was exactly what God had commanded, to spread out and fill the earth. Now contrast that with Abraham. God did not call him to build a city or establish his reputation. Instead, he called Abraham to obedience. And Abraham went where God led, trusted him with the outcome. And God said, "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great." It's always better to let God establish our name than try to build one for ourselves. To find out more about our journey through the Bible, again, text Bible to 67742. That's Bible to 67742. All right, as we've been discussing, The capture of Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro harkens back to the capture of another Latin American strongman, Panama's Manuel Noriega, 36 years ago. Well, on our distinguished panel today, we have one of the original members of the U.S. Army's Delta Force who helped capture Noriega in 1989, retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. General Boykin spent 36 and a half years in the United States Army, serving his last four as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. Currently serves as the Executive Vice President here at the Family Research Council. Also on our panel today is retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, who served 32 years in the U.S. Navy before retiring in 2017. He also served at the National Security Council as Director for Transnational Threats. He is currently a Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. General Boykin, Admiral Montgomery, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Good to be here.
I did be here.
General, let me start with you. Can you remind our viewers and listeners why Panama's Noriega needed to be toppled, why he needed to be detained?
Well, I think your previous speaker laid that out pretty good, but we need to understand also that what prompted George H.W. Bush to finally pull the trigger on that was that Noriega's thugs down there killed an American naval officer and in some ways brutalized his wife. And that was when President Bush said, enough is enough. Go down there and take that country away and turn it back over to the people.
Is there a parallel between the criminal enterprise, the criminal activities that Noriega was involved in, as we now are seeing that Maduro as well was involved in?
Yeah, I think very much so. I mean, this is exactly the same scenario. You had a guy that was pushing drugs into America, and nobody had done anything to try and stop him, and finally it came to this. But I think that it's important to remember that those people that we have gone after, and these are just two of them. There have been others, most of which were on the highly secretive site. But those people are killing Americans. And our president's first duty to the people is to protect the nation.
Admiral Montgomery, I'm going to bring you in here. Unpack for us more of the details from Saturday's capture. What details do we have? What do we know? How did it transpire?
Well, look, I think this was the natural consummation of a three-month pressure campaign by the president. So the president, starting about 3 months ago, very aggressively started to communicate to Maduro and his cronies that your behavior is unacceptable. It began with strikes on boats. It evolved into sanctioning shadow fleet ships, which evolved further into seizing three of those tankers, and then included a Title 50, an intelligence community executed attack on one of their port facilities. So he was ratcheting up. He was offering Maduro the opportunity to leave the country, to get to Cuba on his own, and only when he felt that Maduro wasn't taking him seriously did he then execute what Secretary Rubio has described as a military naval law enforcement operation.
From what we've been able to detect from what was unveiled in court today, the charges that were levied against Maduro and his wife, as I made reference to earlier, it sounds like a criminal enterprise. They were working with the cartels, running drugs, weapons, so on and so forth. I mean, he was using the country as a launching pad for criminal activity that was affecting the United States, is how I read it. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, I think it is. But I would go further. I would say he and his cronies. One thing that worries me is that we've left. Look, he was a bus driver. He wasn't, his choices for him weren't like become a brain surgeon or become president of Venezuela. He wasn't that smart. The people running this criminal enterprise were the Minister of Defense, Pedrino Lopez, and the Minister of Justice Interior, Cabello Rondon. Those two fellas are still there, effectively in charge of the government with a feckless vice president fronting for the two of them. So this is a criminal enterprise. I think as we hear the case play out, we'll recognize that the several of the key co-conspirators are still in Caracas, in charge of the country, and the president needs that. And I think Secretary Rubio's averred to this. And the president initially threatened both of these men with, you're next. And I think he needs to carry through on that, keep that pressure campaign up, and tell these guys, you either go to Cuba, you go join Maduro in New York City, or you're terminated. I mean, those are really the three options for these two guys.
So, in other words, it's time for them to get off the Maduro bus and find a bus stop. So let's play that out for a moment. What does that look like then? Does the United States just help with legitimate elections and raising up the new leadership? I mean, that can't happen overnight. I throw it out there for either one of you.
I do think that I am disappointed slightly in comments about Maria Machado, the leader of the opposition, and Edmundo Gonzalez, the surrogate who stood in for her and won the 2024 elections. I think the president should more clearly state that they are the democratically elected leadership of Venezuela, and either force their installation or force the conduct of elections in the next 3 months so that they can win or not win a free and fair, transparent election overseen by legitimate international observers from the United States.
General Boykin, I'll go back to you. The effort, the operation to take Noriega took a little bit longer than what this happened on Saturday night over the weekend. What was most revealing to you in the capture of Noriega?
Well, I was, we chased him for several days before we finally caught him on, I think it was the 6th of January that we actually were able to get him out of the nunciatura. And I think the thing that kind of puzzled me was once we had him, everybody turned against him. Nobody wanted to be identified as being with him. And that's how so many of these thugs are allowed to do the things they do, is the people that want something from him, they get in behind him. And, you know, just look at the streets of Venezuela today with all the people out there thanking America. He doesn't have any allies. He just has some people that want to hang on for whatever they can get out of it.
Now, I think you also mentioned to me, as you went in and you were able to take him, the depth of depravity that surrounded him and his regime.
That's absolutely. Let me tell you, one of the things that the CIA passed to us while we were there was the fact that he had they had captured some people that told them where there were some people buried that he had actually killed. And when we dug those things up, it was unbelievable how he had mutilated those bodies, even as, you know, they had been in the ground for a while. But the mutilation was just unbelievable as to what he had personally done, according to the CIA's informant. He had done those things, and it was brutal.
And there was a connection to voodoo as well?
I'm sorry, to whom?
The religious connotations, voodoo and other occult activities surrounding his regime.
We hit every safe house he had. And in every safe house, he had a satanic altar on one side, and he had a Christian altar on the other side. And, of course, you know the story of his red underwear. If you don't mind me saying, he wore red underwear to ward off the evil. And he was the evil. But and ultimately, when we captured him, they confirmed, or he confirmed, why he was wearing those. But he was a complex character, but he was evil from the start to go.
I'll mention that if you'd like to see that red underwear, it's at Fort Bragg. People can see that at the museum.
It is in the museum at the Delta Force compound. And
thanks to General Jerry Boykin.
I made the mistake of saying the only thing I want is those red drawers. And my doctor brought them to me afterwards, so I got rid of them as quickly as I can.
Admiral, what can we expect to see in Venezuela? I mean, this is a very prosperous country. They have tremendous oil reserves there in that country. How long does it take them to get back on their feet, and what's going to be required?
First, it reminds me to say how honored I am to be here with General Boykin, a real war hero. And one thing he reminded me of is a unique opportunity we had in the Panama was that General Boykin and other Army officers and myself and other Navy officers, we knew hundreds of our peers in the Panamanian forces because we'd gone to war college together, been stationed together. One of the problems we have in Venezuela is we've cut off that training program legitimately, correctly, for 25 years. So right now we don't have that colonel to colonel, general to general. We went to school together relationship. So this is going to make things tougher for us going forward, not having that military to military where we can lean in to former classmates at Army War College or West Point, you know, that you normally have. You know, going forward, answering your question, look, I think it's really critical that the United States get these, you know, push forward elections for, you know, for a transparent set of elections that are run fairly. And let the Venezuelan people decide. I think they will. One of the things that worries me is the sovereign wealth fund of Venezuela, which was enormous 25 years ago, because they have the world's largest proven reserves of oil, 300 billion barrels still. They have no sovereign wealth fund. It's been looted by the Machado regime. And their oil infrastructure outside of what Chevron is operating has been allowed to become dilapidated and in sore need of billions, with a B, billions of dollars of investment. And that's what the president was kind of reaching out to Phillips, Conoco, and Exxon, asking them to step in to get that part of the treasury going again. So it's going to be a real problem going forward for Venezuela for at least a half decade or decade.
Both of you know that when a regime change takes place and a strong man is removed, that evil abhors a vacuum and often fills that vacuum. And in the situation, the latter is sometimes worse than the former. I know no one wants to hear this word, and the administration has refused to say that this is going to happen, but will an occupation of that country be required by the United States to give them time to get on their feet and to keep that evil from grabbing the reins?
I'm going to let the Admiral answer that question.
I hope not. I don't think, look, we've had, one of the things I will say is I'm not sure that we've planned out the, you know, the transition here. We once again, you know, we're facing a situation where we have done the first thing first, done a good job. I don't think the American people would be excited about an occupation. I have to tell you, if you tell me you need 10,000 infantry people in position to like enforce our will, we all know that for the U.S. military, that means we have 40 to 50,000 joint force kind of supporting that. You know, where we are a large footprint. When we go in, we don't put our men and women at risk wantonly. So if we were to get involved, we would be all in involved. And even though it's in our hemisphere, so it's a little less demanding on our logistics, it's still very demanding on the military. So I'm really hoping that's not the answer going forward. But I have not heard a transition, you know, plan from the executive, you know, from the administration yet that explains how they're going to do this. So I do worry, and that's a legitimate concern you raise.
Admiral, General, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Insightful conversation, and thank both of you. I thank both of you for your service to our country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Obviously, we're going to find out more as the days go on, but certainly something to be praying about. Until next time, I leave you once again with the words of the Apostle Paul, who says, you've done everything you can do, and you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand. By all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council. To support our efforts to advance faith, family, and freedom, please text GIVE to 67742. That's GIVE to 67742. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information, please visit TonyPerkins.com.